Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight, the movie geeks pay tribute to a fearless and uncompromising filmmaker with a little help from four stellar actors, Thomas G. Waits, William Forsythe, Dana Delaney, and Jeff Goldblum, a special two-hour celebration of the cinematic genius that is Paul Schrader. Coming up next on Movie Geeks United. This is Movie Geeks United, another one of our great two-hour tribute shows tonight. My name is Jamie, and I'm joined, as usual, by my trusted co-host and companion, Jerry.
Hey, what's up, man? This is it. This is the big one.
This is big. This is the biggest show we've ever had. What a caliber of talent we have. Thomas G. Waits, who we've welcomed on the show before for our Pacino tribute.
Right.
Fantastic actor. Iconic films he's been a part of. The Warriors, The Thing.
The Thing right there. I mean, just two early classics right there.
What more do you need? And he's worked with Schrader and Pacino and countless other like legendary people. William Forsythe, who is fantastic.
He's like one of our quintessential, tough guy actors, character actors, and he's just great. I mean, whatever he's in, it's William Forsythe. He brings a lot of screen presence, I think, to everything.
Yeah, and his latest movie, might I just say, is with Pacino.
Yeah,
he stars opposite Pacino.
Don't hide it.
I'm going to flaunt it. And then we're going to welcome Dana Delaney. Tell us about somebody that's just on top of the world. I mean, she's on the cover of Entertainment Weekly this week. A big role on Desperate Housewives. She's been a major fixture in movie and TV fans' lives for the past 20 years.
Like, I agree. It's like really funny. Like 20 years ago, introduced to her really on China Beach.
Yeah,
one of the hit shows. When I was my senior year of high school, and here she is on Desperate Housewives.
Yeah,
I think that's incredible.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And still looks gorgeous, by the way.
Oh, she's timeless beauty.
Yeah,
timeless.
And then, of course, speaking of timeless beauty, Jeff Goldblum.
That name right there, it says it all.
Amazing.
He's in everything.
Amazing.
And he brings, he has this unique presence in each film.
Just an enormous talent, and even more of an enormous heart, and he just radiates from him, and I feel very positive about this interview. Just Mr. Goldblum is a big hero to us.
Oh, he is.
On the show. So what a great show, and speaking of heroes, and the reason why we're here, and all the other talent is here tonight, it's not because of us, it's because of Mr. Schrader, a fantastic talent. And so let's start from the beginning, and in between these interviews, we'll try to intersperse some information about Mr. Schrader and our feelings on his resume of great films.
Sounds good to me.
He was born in 1946 in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Very strict family upbringing. They were Calvinists, weren't they?
Yes. I mean, it informs his. I think you would honestly have to say it informs his scripts and his directorial films, and it informs the things he wrote with his brother.
Yeah.
I mean, that upbringing right there.
Well, and just take a look at his resume, having written the screenplays to Taxi Driver, Raging Bull, Bringing Out the Dead, some Last Temptation of Christ, some of the great Scorsese wrote the screenplay for, and directing movies like Affliction, and Autofocus, and Hardcore, and Blue Collar, and American Gigolo. This is a big career. But he was forbidden from watching movies as a kid. He's not one of those like Scorsese that lived with a movie theater since the age of five.
Yeah,
he saw his first movie at the age of 18.
Yeah, I couldn't imagine that. I mean, I know it's, But then he comes from a generation of there are people like that where movies were forbidden. And he comes from a you know, that kind of upbringing. Here, let me find this quote. Other college kids had to vandalize government buildings. All we had to do to rebel was go to the movies. Right. I think that says it all right there.
Yeah. What was the first movie he saw?
Oh, that I don't. What was it? Please, if you know, tell me.
Anatomy of a Murder.
Anatomy of a Murder. Oh my.
And he said that after he saw it, he felt like he was going to go into a panic attack.
That's the absolute first movie he saw.
Yeah, yeah, I believe so. I believe that's what I read.
Oh wow, we're talking about just going in cold. Oh my.
Absolutely. So man, it must have been kind of a traumatic experience. I mean, especially, you know, when you forbid your child from doing something, what does that kind of instill in that child?
An overly
kind of morbid curiosity on that thing you're being forbidden to do.
Yeah, but think what that did, and it's very interesting. For 18 years to not have access to that, and then for the rest of your life, and the people who probed him and to get him involved, and really Pauline Kael, who really turned him towards the path of the film.
Yeah.
Look what they unleashed.
It's important to note that he started, like you mentioned, Pauline Kael, who was one of the most influential critics of the 20th century. He started under her influence or tutelage, or at least with her initial inspiration,
right.
as a film critic himself.
Right, for the LA Weekly, right?
Yeah, I believe so. He did, you know, I think he gave an unfavorable review to Easy Rider, and he championed De Palma's early thriller Sisters.
Yes, he did, and that led to Obsession.
They eventually collaborated together. And then he decided to go off and make films himself. He was thinking of writing screenplays, and his first screenplay, correct me if I'm wrong, was done with his brother for a Sidney Pollack film.
It's a movie that I do like, The Yakuza.
Yeah.
With Robert Mitchum and I want to say Ken Watanabe, not Ken Watanabe. Who is the older Japanese actor who... There's a famous Japanese actor that he co-stars with in that film.
Know who you're talking about.
You know, because he's been in a lot of films. A lot of people would recognize him.
And then he started writing. He started writing screenplays, and the one that really broke, and the one that I think really cemented his commitment to become a director himself as well, out of his collaboration with Martin Scorsese, is Taxi Driver.
Yeah.
We're going to talk a lot about Taxi Driver after this first segment because our guest is on the line. But talk about just, you know, there's the difference between good movies and great movies, and I think that Taxi Driver will live forever because the chemistry was just there. It's something that can't be defined. They were all in that place at that time, and it just all melded and made a timeless movie as a result of that.
Right.
And it's very interesting what he was going through when he was writing Taxi Driver. It is largely kind of an autobiographical story of his mental state at that time. You know, talking about writing what you know.
and he did.
Yeah, and that's a fascinating story. We'll get into that after our first segment here, but he's on the line. Let's get right to it. Our loyal listeners may recall our tribute to Al Pacino last summer when we first welcomed our next guest. His collaborations with giants like Pacino and Schrader, not to mention Walter Hill and John Carpenter, speak volumes of his tremendously versatile gifts as an actor. And Justice for All, Light of Day, The Warriors, The Thing, and countless landmark TV series like NYPD Blue, Oz, and Law & Order grace his resume, as well as a lifetime of unforgettable work on the stage. And like all truly great and generous artists, he shares his craft and his hard-earned lessons through his Thomas G. Waits Acting School in New York City. It is a great pleasure to welcome back to the show actor, director, playwright, and teacher, Mr. Thomas G. Waits. Mr. Waits, are you with us?
Hi, how you guys doing? All right?
I'm doing great. It's great to have you back on.
Welcome
Thank
back.
You. Thank you so much. It's great to be back.
Thank you. Hey, you're really busy right now. You got a performance coming up tomorrow night, don't you?
Yeah, I'm doing a staged reading of a play called Killer Midgets.
I like it already.
You sold me right there.
It's a wild new play by John DiPolito. Kevin Anderson and I are doing a staged reading of it at the Algonquin Theater. It's a sold-out performance, which is good for us.
Oh, yeah.
And it's very caustic black absurdist comedy about these two guys that haven't gone out of the house in 8 years.
we can certainly relate to that.
Yeah, I can relate to that. I mean, no doubt.
Only to be attacked by three little people.
Oh,
you used that political correct term there. Okay.
Right.
Well, that sounds like quite a show. So it's a one night only thing? Or?
Yeah, we have some backers coming, so we're hoping to take it to the next stage.
Oh, break a leg on that. That sounds incredible. And how's your school going? I just want to catch up before we get into Mr. Schrader.
Yeah,
if
you go to thomasgwaits.com, which one word lowercase, you can see all about the school. And I teach down on 23rd Street. I have a beautiful class of hardworking actors. I teach on Monday nights from 7 to 11. And so please check out the website, thomasgwaits.com, and you can see and hear everything you need to know there.
Yeah, it's a great website, a great school. So let's get to Mr. Schrader.
You worked with
Mr. Schrader on Light of Day,
mm-hmm.
But prior to meeting and working with him, what kind of films of his were you particularly taken by?
Well, I heard somebody just talking about Taxi Driver. I mean,
yeah.
God, I mean, how could you be an actor and not watch Taxi Driver? You talking to me? I mean, you know, it's like I think, you know, Paul Schrader. I first was hired to coach the actresses that were up for the parts. That Joan
Jett.
Yeah.
Okay.
The one that Joan Jett eventually did. And so, you know, I worked with Paul, like, on the other side of the desk for a change. You know, the casting director, Bonnie Timmerman, called me and said, look, we have this project. We're looking for somebody to coach these singers on their acting. Would you be interested? I said, sure, to work with Paul Schrader. Are you kidding? So I got to watch Paul in the audition process. I got to watch him craft this great script. And, you know, he had such a vision for this thing. You know, he was such a passionate guy.
Mm.
And you know, very sensitive, like really, really quietly reserved, which is interesting because he has this violent, you know, aspect to his personality that comes out in his movies. Did you ever
see
it? Blue Collar?
You see it.
Yeah.
I mean,
there in each film, really.
Yes, right. And Yakuza, I heard you mentioning that.
Yeah, it's there.
You know, and he's this intelligent, I don't know if he went to Harvard or Yale or where he studied, but he's a very bright guy, you know. And so he hired me to do this coaching, and it was very interesting. I was just beginning as a teacher back in those days. I was still, you know, applying my craft as an actor, but I started to do some teaching on the side. And, you know, I was working with these women, and I would have to give him reports.
Mm-hmm.
So I would go over to his apartment, and Mary Beth would answer the door, and his little girl Molly would be there. And we would go off into the back room, and he'd say, okay. And I'd have these reports written up, and I would read them to him, and he would sit there and listen very carefully, very methodically, you know, sort of stroking his chin, going, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So you think that, you think this? I'd say, yeah, you know. And, you know, then finally it came down to the actual screen testing for the thing. Paul's a very, you know, I experienced him as a very inclusive person. He always included everybody from, you know, the craft service guy to the big star on the set, and everybody in between.
That's cool.
Yeah.
You know, you were part of the Paul Schrader family when you worked for him. I loved him. I loved working with him. Very intense on the set.
You know, I was going to ask you some questions about how he directs, but just the movie itself, I remember watching this, and I'm going to give away my age. I'm 34, so I was a teenager when it came out. I remember watching it and just being so completely taken by it, and it's one of my favorite films, and yet you can't find it anywhere anymore, which is a shame. I can't find it on DVD. I'm hoping that they'll release it soon, but just an amazing film and one that I don't think got the credit it deserved.
I agree.
Yeah.
You know, what's interesting about that film is Michael J. Fox actually played the guitar.
Mm.
He had a guitar with him, like, attached to his hip every place he went with the teacher.
Yeah,
I believe it.
Practicing like a madman.
I believe it. Because that's the first film for him. That's a new kind of role for him, because
mm-hmm.
he was trying to really break away from the Family Ties, Back to the Future image
right.
that he
that, that was that was pre-De Palma Casualties of War. I mean,
yeah, and Trader is responsible for bringing out this new persona in him.
Yeah, he is a fun guy to work with. Oh, my God. You know, this is back in his heyday, so, like, every place you went, he'd be attacked by, you know, crowds of teenagers.
That's right.
Throngs of kids would be chasing him down the hall. It was like being with the Beatles.
I remember that era, yeah.
It was really fun, and, you know, we would hide out in his hotel room, and he'd say, well, you know, go get me a beer because I can't go out there, you know. It was really fun.
Is it true that I read, maybe this is just a rumor, that the project started as something that Springsteen might headline because he was considering going into an acting career?
You know, I heard that too, and, you know, of course he wrote that song Just Around the Corner.
Yeah.
Light of Day. Right. I heard that he was interested in that, and I'm sure that everyone would have been, they would have loved to have Springsteen in a film.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing about Bruce, you know, he just, what I heard, now this could be completely not true, is that he felt he wasn't ready.
Right.
I mean, could you imagine, I don't know if you've ever seen Springsteen on stage. He's the greatest live performer.
No one touches him, yeah.
Nobody comes to, he's the greatest live actor, really.
Right,
even though he
right.
sings the stories and he becomes the character. But there's also a humility to him.
Mm.
And I think in a way he became the archetype that Mike was trying to pattern the character after.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, so that they got that real grit, but at the same time the humility. That's a very unusual characteristic for a great star to have.
Yeah, very much so. And then Springsteen has it in spades. So you had a nice experience making the film. Tell me how Mr. Schrader directs. Is he very verbal with you, or is that pretty much done pre-production?
He's a watcher. He's watching everything.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't even appear to blink, as I recall. I remember sitting there going, does this guy ever look away? You know, does he ever blink? Does he ever, like, you know, doesn't he have anything else going on in his mind but what's going on in front of him? It's like this powerful concentration.
Yeah.
About what he's, almost like it's a holy experience.
Right, right.
Almost like there's a reverence. And he seems to really connect with actors. You know, he speaks in very quiet tones, and he comes up, and he kind of reminds me of what Kazan must have been like.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know,
that's a good analogy.
You know, real, like, trying to get you to personalize it. And very charming when he wants to be. Very charming, and at the same time, in complete command of this set.
You know, it's so interesting that you say that he so completely focused, like a laser focus and unblinking, because that's how I see his films. I'm sure this word's going to come up time and time again. What characterizes his films for me is that they are so fearless, especially in exploring the kind of dark depths that he goes to.
Mm-hmm.
Just unblinking and unflinching. I mean, he goes to those places full out. He's fully committed to that. So you guys shot this in Illinois, didn't you?
I think it was in Cleveland.
Yeah, it's got a real strong sense of place.
I think we were in Cleveland, as I recall. We were in Cleveland, and
okay,
you know that was, I remember it was, you know, that was before the, it was right around the time that our cities were razed by the crack plague.
Right.
So you could see the deserted, abandoned streets of Cleveland, and you know the tough kind of, you know, alcoholic environment that this play took place in, you know, the lower class, blue collar mentality, the kind of, you know, the death of the American dream. And, you know, he captured that grit and captured, and I think you're right, you know, I think he's a tough guy.
Oh, yeah. Totally.
You know, I think he's a tough guy. He what was that movie, Cat People?
Yeah, the remake of Cat People, yeah.
I thought that was like a great movie.
Oh, it's a good. That has some iconic moments in it. I mean, people won't admit it, but it really does.
Yeah, I mean, the original was a classic and everything, but I thought John Hurd was terrific in that movie.
Oh, amazing! And he does pull great performances. And you mentioned his casting. He has very unique. He makes some very unique casting choices. You talk about matching Michael J. Fox with Joan Jett.
Right.
but it works like gangbusters.
Yeah,
I mean,
it was very interesting chemistry because there were a lot of people that were up for that part, a lot of great actresses. Ellen Barkin was up for it, and a woman named Fiona Shaw. I don't know whatever happened to her. She was a singer. And
I remember her.
Yeah,
I remember that name.
And you know, he had the studio. It was a big studio picture, so the studio executives were around, and I saw Paul also as a diplomat.
Right.
You know, that's a very heavy position to be in with those big guys around.
Yeah.
And usually it's a role that an artist is not necessarily adept at playing.
Well, he was funny. I remember him saying to me once, I go, well, how do you deal with it, Paul? You know, how do you deal with the pressure of doing a big studio picture? And he goes, well, I ask them one question first. I say, before you say anything to me right now, do you have to say this to me? That's what I need to know. Is there anyone, are there any of my staff here that could take care of this problem that you're about to talk to me about before you get to me? Because I have other things on my mind.
Right.
Now, if they can't take care of it, then okay, we'll talk. And I use that myself as a director if I can, you know. Go to the stage manager first, you know, go to the assistant stage manager first, and if you have to come to me for a creative problem. I saw him very much as a creative guy.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's amazing to me because I read interviews with him time and time again where it's still a struggle of many years to find funding for each movie he has to do.
Yeah. What this world has come to. I mean, a great artist like that, he should be able to snap his finger and do whatever he wants whenever he wants.
In a perfect world, yes.
But it's getting tougher, you know. It's getting tougher because the market has changed so drastically. And, you know, I was doing an interview earlier with somebody else for a magazine, you know, they cover the horror genre. So they were interviewing me about the thing. And I was saying to them, you know, everything is so focused on the youth of our generation. And that's good. You know, the youth is a beautiful thing. But let's not forget the wisdom of experience. You know, let's not forget the people that, you know, taught us what we know.
I agree.
And that's why we feel so honored to be able to do shows like this and kind of celebrate and pay tribute to these artists that paved the way for everyone that we see now.
And they're still doing it. I mean,
absolutely.
I'm sure wherever Paul Schrader is, he's got a script, he's got an idea, he's got
and
a story.
We have an interview later on in the show with Jeff Goldblum,
and
he's speaking about the upcoming collaboration that they've done together, Adam Resurrected. I think it's probably going to see its release later on in the year. It sounds like the most daring thing that Mr. Schrader's ever attempted in his career, listening to it. I mean, constantly challenging himself.
Yeah, Jeff Goldblum's a very interesting, very exciting actor to watch. I mean, the guy is gold every time out.
Yeah.
I mean,
it
doesn't appear that there's a frame that doesn't have gold in it.
I made sure I let him know that. The Fly, has there ever been a performance like The Fly?
He's great.
Horrifying and heartbreaking all at once.
Very, very intelligent actor.
Now, you mentioned, are you from New York?
I was born in Philadelphia.
I
moved to New York when I was 18 to study acting at Juilliard.
Because we talked briefly about Taxi Driver, and I want to close on this because we're going to continue talking about Taxi Driver after the segment. What does that film get right about New York? I mean, New York is certainly a character of its own in that film.
It gets everything right. It gets everything right. There is an edge to living in New York that gets sharper with each passing day.
I believe it.
And if you don't walk on the edge, you'll die.
Yeah.
It's a tough place, and you got to be a tough guy to survive it. And I think what he captures is that internal combustion that everybody, you know, deals with all day long and just how they process it. And the great thing about that movie was, you know, De Niro's character was so malevolently charming.
Yeah.
I mean, he made you love him and hate him in the same breath. And that takes a great actor, it takes great writing, and, you know, we're really lucky to have those guys still around giving us their work.
Yeah, absolutely. Mr. Waits, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for coming
back. Hey, thanks for having me.
call into our show anytime. We can just sit with you for hours and talk about the craft of acting. It's
I love it.
Fun.
Thank you so much.
Thank
Bye.
You. Bye-bye now. That is an actor we all love so much, Thomas Waits, speaking about his collaboration with Mr. Schrader in Light of Day. Taxi Driver, first of all.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a monster on your resume. I don't care who
that,
you are.
Yeah, I don't really, yeah, I mean, that is, and that's the second script.
Yes.
That's the second screenplay is Taxi Driver.
First of all, the movie is phenomenal, and a lot of credit has to go to Scorsese. I think someone could take Schrader's script, and someone else could take Schrader's script and make a good or a great movie from it. But the one that is as timeless and as feverish and as unique as Scorsese made it. You know, Scorsese really made it pop. That's a truly great collaboration. But talk about from a writer's standpoint. I think he was living that life. What I read about him, he was very depressed. He went to the doctor one time. I think he broke a bone or something. And he talked to the nurse, and he realized, this is the first time in weeks I have spoken to another living being. That's how easy, you know, we talked about Collateral a couple weeks ago in L.A., and the theme of that film and some others like it, where there's such a disconnect where a dead person can be riding a subway for days before anyone notices him.
Yeah. Let me say something about living.
This is an ultimate outsider here, this Travis Bickle.
Yeah, he is the Holden Caulfield of the 70s. In some regard, if you want to go there. I just that just came to me right now, but
well, that sounds like a good analogy.
Okay, thank you. Thanks. But I have lived in Los Angeles, and that's a good way you can go live there your whole life and not bump into another person. I mean, it's really amazing for such a large metropolis. It's all spread out. It's like one large suburb almost. But
mm-hmm.
You could really spend your whole life and really not run into another soul. Go about your business. It's really strange. So it's funny to hear New York described like that. But you're right. The analogy
yeah.
to Collateral is absolutely right.
And it's telling that this is a complete and utter psychopath in the film. And yet you sympathize so greatly with him. There's
yeah.
a large percentage of that character who's motivated just by the nature of not just being lonely, but being bored. I mean, there's that great scene where he's in his room and he's rocking back and forth with a TV before the TV falls,
yeah.
and he's just a dead man walking.
Yeah.
You know?
And he identified Schrader with the Vietnam veteran because
yeah.
not only does he do Taxi Driver, he does Rolling Thunder a couple years
mm-hmm.
later. And he he really identifies with the damaged psyche, the damaged personality, or damaged goods, really.
Schrader himself said that, you know, he'd be walking the streets of New York at night, you know, the terrible, gritty places, you know, and then visiting porn theaters at all hours of the night, you know, it's just a depressive state. And that's what inspires me. He took that, and he made art with it,
yep.
art that will live on forever.
Absolutely.
That is what is so gorgeous about what an artist does, and this art form in particular.
Yeah.
And Taxi Driver, I mean, it's timeless. Let's play a clip from Taxi Driver.
Okay.
And this gives you a little clue as to, you know, first of all, Schrader's crafting of the lead character's inner monologue, which most of it is inner monologue. And plus the feverish nature of the film, the way Scorsese put it together, and it's all kind of emblemized by this frantic score from Bernstein, which
right.
was the final score that he did.
Right.
Here's a clip from Taxi Driver.
June 29th. I gotta get in shape now. Too much sitting has ruined my body. Too much abuse has gone on for too long. From now on, it'll be 50 push-ups each morning. 50 pull-ups. There'll be no more pills. There'll be no more bad food. No more destroyers of my body. From now on, it'll be total organization. Every muscle must be tight.
Haunting, man.
Yes, it is.
And that clip really does speak to the full arc of the movie too, because
it does.
The only catharsis, the only release that this character can enjoy is an act of extreme violence.
Mm-hmm.
and he becomes rewarded. He's rewarded as a hero because he killed the pimp and he saved the teenage prostitute
right.
at the end of it. But as that last shot, and I think the last shot's been debated in that film quite a bit, where he's driving his taxi and he looks like, does a second take in the rearview mirror and adjusts it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a weird kind of zinger on the soundtrack. He's still crazy.
Oh, no, he is.
He is one of the disturbed. That is still walk, and only in New York City
yeah.
can that man be celebrated as a hero.
That's true. It's really interesting. There was talk a couple of years ago, and this, maybe we should ask Schrader if this is true,
yeah.
of a sequel to Taxi Driver.
Yeah, yeah. I think he shot it down. But I think it's very interesting, 30 years later, where is Travis Bickle? And I think the closest that we're going to get is Bringing Out the Dead. And we discussed this before.
Yeah.
I see a real full circle thing going on with Bring Out the Dead, whereas the catharsis, the only relief that character could get from Taxi Driver was through an act of violence. And Bring Out the Dead, he's living through the same turmoil, the
mm-hmm.
same environment, and the only thing he wants at the end is peace. You know, I think that's a real maturity rising up. That's the passage of time and age and all that kind of stuff. Weaving into that story, I see it as a real full circle arc between those two films.
Oh yeah, it's definitely there. The maturity and what he did. I mean, his collaborations with Scorsese are classic.
Yeah,
there's no doubt about that.
Yeah,
but it's,
and now are we ready to explore some more directorial works from him?
With yes, we are.
Next guest? Let's do it. We're so excited about this. We have been flooded with messages. Ever since we announced our next guest's presence on tonight's show, there's no doubt about it, William Forsythe is one of the most interesting, intense, and beloved character actors out there. For more than 25 years, he's delivered phenomenal performances in a slew of great films like Once Upon a Time in America, Raising Arizona, Weeds, Extreme Prejudice, Dick Tracy, The Water Dance, Things to Do in Denver When You're Dead, The Rock, City by the Sea, Freedom Land, and Rob Zombie's The Devil's Rejects and Halloween. In 1988, he collaborated with Paul Schrader on the gripping film Patty Hearst, and he can next be seen on the big screen starring opposite my hero, yes, Al Pacino, in the thriller 88 Minutes, opening everywhere on April 18th. It is a tremendous pleasure to welcome a great actor to our show, Mr. William Forsythe. Mr. Forsythe, are you with us?
I am. How's it going?
Hey, thank you so much for doing our show tonight.
Thank you. This is awesome.
It's a real honor for us.
My pleasure, guys.
I wanted to talk to you very briefly, get a sense of how you started in the business before we get into Mr. Schrader. When did that bug first bite you, the acting bug?
Well, I got forced to do a play when I was 10 years old. I was 10 years old in grammar school, and I had I was kind of a bit of a juvenile delinquent at that point, and I got captured, caught doing something, and basically the teacher I had forced me to do a play. So that's how I did my first play. You know, how I got the bug was I was about 14 years old. I went to see a production of Sound of Music, and I saw there were like 30 girls on the play and like six guys. And I thought, oh, man, you know, I could do this. So, you know, it got started for all the wrong reasons, but I caught up right away.
Oh, I see nothing wrong with that reasoning at all.
Those are great reasons.
Yeah, but what fascinates me is that you were maybe 4 or 5 years into building your career in films, and you're given this opportunity to be directed by Sergio Leone.
Yeah.
Of all people, tell me about that experience.
It's at the moment I knew that the whole experience was special, but. I didn't realize how special. I mean, he was really an amazing man, an amazing director, and really pulled me out of a world of thousands and thousands and thousands of people. I remember I had they had asked me to do a monologue and come in and do the monologue. So I wrote a monologue really quickly, and I ran down there and I did it, you know. And it was funny, my grandfather, he had this thing that when he got mad, sometimes his eye would just like, you know, and I just remember just using that little choice. I threw it in there. I had no idea. Well, the next thing I know, I get a call from Sergio, and it's like, come back now. And he basically, you know, tells me, that thing you did with your eye. When I first imagined this part, I always dreamed of you. It was like, whoa, thank you.
Wow.
That's great.
Yeah, because I was delivering singing telegrams, working as a bartender and a doorman, you know. Yeah. Like, you know, struggling at that moment, so.
Well, you've worked with some of the greats. I mean, Leone, Walter Hill, and Beatty, and of course, Schrader. When you look at all these great directors, do they have something in common, all great directors?
Well, you know, everyone is different. Everyone's different, but the great guys, the great ones have a great eye, and they have a very, very strong idea of what of where they're going and what they want to do. And I've also found that, you know, the greatest directors I feel that I've ever worked with, they, you know, they let you go. You're like a wild animal, you know, and they
yeah.
and they kind of like can control a bit of that, but they allow you to go to those places because that's where you get the most interesting work.
Oh yeah. And on the flip side, what about Schrader is unique amongst those directors?
Well, God, I mean, I can't even explain it. I went in to meet Paul. You know, I mean, I basically went in and I was huge. I had just finished some movie I did, I think with Willie Nelson was in it or something, and I was playing this big old boy. And,
right.
And I went in literally probably about 260 pounds. And I just remember that Paul Schrader looks up at me, and I could see in his eyes, those eyes, those intelligent eyes. I could see right away, you know, I was like almost done. You know, it was like from then on it was going to be a courtesy, you know. And then he, you know, we said, let's go, let's read or whatever. And, and that moment happened, and I went off. And then I could see something in him grow, and, you know, and it just started this dance. And, you know, and he's so deep in his head, you know. It's like he says what he says, but, you know, he thinks what he thinks, you know.
Right.
And it just started to be this dance with Paul. And then by the time the meeting's over, he looks at me and he goes, can you lose the weight? You know, and he was so calculated. And I mean, you know, I mean, the whole experience with Paul was really a unique experience. It, in a way, it was what I imagined great movies were going to be when I was younger. But
right.
But it didn't end up that way with a lot of movies. I mean, we did everything. We went, we lived together for 2 weeks. We became the SLA. We lived in an apartment in San Francisco, just like they lived. We trained all day, you know. At night, we saw amazing people. Guests would come in from, you know, from the day, from the era. And some people would come in the dead of night, and we'd have these amazing, amazing seminars where we would just learn and learn and learn. I mean, it's just like, you know, the commitment. And, you know, and all of us as actors and young actors, I mean, it was like we were just loving it. I mean, I can't even tell you. I mean, if you stayed up past midnight and you were like, you know, one of the ones who were hanging out partying or whatever, we did it in a closet. You know? That's where we hung out, you know.
I can't imagine how valuable that time was for you as an actor to kind of craft your performance, because after a while you probably wouldn't even have to think about it.
Well, you do. And you know, and the guy I played is a really trippy guy. I mean, he's an irritating guy. I mean, the guy was, you know, I mean, he, you know, his whole thing was he wanted to be black, and he just, you know, this guy was just so strange, Bill Harris. I mean, that he literally wore blackface, and he was just such an out-there character, you know, amongst all these guys. And it was really a very trippy experience. I mean, I know as I got more into being that guy, I started getting on everybody's nerves, you know, like the real Bill Harris. And I went, oh, my God, it's really, you could, I mean, I felt it was really happening. And it was, and you know, for me, I look back on that experience as being one of the most amazing because of how we did it. And, you know, I mean, just, I mean, we went all the way. I mean, and when we made that movie, it was just, I mean, it was as if we were the SLA for that whole time.
Wow.
Yeah, and I think it is indicative of how Mr. Schrader works. I mean, we're just talking that he is an all the way kind of guy. I mean, that let's explore these depths as far as they'll take us. Just fearless. And I'm going to use that word all the time tonight. It's my favorite word in describing him. I mean, it really does encapsulate what he is as a filmmaker.
I mean, I was very aware of who Paul was, you know, early on because I mean, I was, you know, I mean, I began, you know, pre-Paul with the Mean Streets, that whole, I discovered Scorsese and those guys. So when Taxi Driver happened, and I knew that he had written this script, and but what got me was, the first time I ever discovered him was in Hardcore.
Me too, yes.
That movie blew me away. I mean, where you know, I just went, oh, my God, this is so good. You know, and it was Paul, you know. And it's just one of those things. I mean, he, you know, he's gritty. He gets down. He is fearless. And he's wild. I mean, you know, some of the things, you know, like he and I would, you know, we'd have arguments that just, like, it was just amazing. And then it would just, I'd see some smile come over him as we were doing it, you know, and I was like, yeah, I love you. You know, and as an experience, I mean, it's an unforgettable one for me.
Well, this picture itself, the whole Patty Hearst experience, I mean, it's a very kind of sensational, and it could be a very tabloidish story, but that's not the treatment that you guys were going after with this film, was it?
Not at all.
No, I mean, from Paul's concept of doing it all, you know, from her perspective and where that all was going. I mean, we were just trying, you know, we tried to become those guys, to have that rhetoric and that belief and that sense, and find those places, you know, to Patty, you know. So we were in deep, you know. And it was trippy. I mean, you turn around and there's Patty Hearst, you know.
She was the presence. She was the presence on the set.
I was standing looking in a mirror, doing that scene, which I is unbelievable, with me in blackface and that wig on.
Right.
And I'm standing there, like, you know, improvising that scene, and which Paul graciously let me do. And I remember, like, you know, Patty Hearst, like, was watching it, you know, and she just, like, and I knew. I said, oh, man, yeah, she's getting the vibe like it's really happening again, you know. So it was, it was really great. And, you know, Paul's just, you know, he was an unpredictable, beautiful, you know, wild character, you know.
Is there a lot of talk when he directs? I mean, how does he direct you?
Well, I mean, just look at the process that we went about, you know. I mean, just, like, we were all living it, you know. So there, you know, there'd be times when it would be, you know, I mean, he'd blunt. I mean, you know, whatever he wanted. You know, he'd put it out there. And if you had your thought, you'd go at it, whatever, or, you know. But right to it, you know. He was just, you know, a right-to-it guy, you know. I mean, he knows, and then when things would happen, that's what he loves, you know. Because that's what sparks. You get,
right.
You know, you get the rock and the flint, you know.
Well, we have a phone call on a 703 area code. Let's pick it up, see if one of our listeners has a question for you here.
Sure.
Let me see here. 703, go right ahead. You're on.
Yes, is Miss Delaney around?
Sorry, you must have the wrong number. All right, that's the last time I pick up a line tonight.
That was good, though.
That's good. Well, all right. All right, compared to you've worked, as we said, with a lot of great directors, I have to ask you, what is it like working for Rob Zombie?
Well, Rob blew me away because Rob is really, you know, we're talking about, you know, like guys who began in the 70s, and we're talking about that era, right? Rob is in that era.
Yeah.
He's funny that way. And when he called me up, I mean, we met on the phone. And I spoke to him for about an hour to an hour and a half. And by the time it was over with, we agreed we were going to do the movie together. And, you know, and he, man, his love of, like, my heroes, guys I love, like Robert Shaw, Lee Marvin, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, and it's funny you bring that up because that's what you, in a lot of the movies that I really admire you in, that's what you remind me of, Lee Marvin.
Bless your heart.
No, I mean, I'm going to say this right now. Two movies are really... love that you're in our Palookaville and Things to Do in Denver When You're Dead.
Yeah.
You're the man. I'm just going to say that.
We're slobbering fans here.
Yeah, please. I'm just going to have to say that.
Well, those are two of my favorite films. I mean, as far as, you know, independent film goes, I mean, you know, I mean, Things to Do in Denver is a classic, and, you know, and Palookaville was, you know, that movie was when I first saw it, I said, this movie should be seen by, like, everybody. You know,
yeah,
it shouldn't be
right,
like an art
absolutely.
Film. You know, it's a film people laugh at, and I kind of felt like the distribution of it was a little, you know, not quite what it could have been. But,
right.
But whatever, we make movies.
That's right.
Well,
that's right.
Mr. Forsyth, I know that you mentioned hardcore, and that's a particular favorite of mine, and we're going to be playing a clip from that a little bit later and discussing it after the segment. But I'm sure that you've kept up with some of Schrader's more recent work, too. What do you think his legacy is or will be in motion pictures?
Well, You know, it's hard to say because, like, we all go through so many different stages in our career. But, I mean, look, everyone's always going to, you know, I mean, I believe, think of Paul, you know, as you know, look, hardcore is as real as it gets when a man goes through, you know, watching, you know, his guts being ripped out inside and where he's willing to go, you know.
Yeah.
And that, you know, and that's, you know, when you look at, you know, Taxi Driver and you look at Raging Bull, you know, in terms of his, you know, in his screenplays, and you just, you know, and the guts of his films, you know, it's just, you know, that's what you'll, you know, remember is, I mean, here's this guy, you know, who's, you know, he's scrappy as hell, competitive, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll tell you another funny story. I mean, when I agreed to lose the weight, you know, so they decided they're going to send me off to this place, you know, a very famous place where you go and usually spend a week and, you know, you know, go there, eat good food, and work out, you know.
It's well, a fat camp.
Yeah. So I'm at, it's actually luxury fat camp, so.
Right.
You know,
right.
Hanging, you know. So I get sent to luxury fat camp, and I'm in heaven. I'm, like, you know, working out 6 hours a day and eating great food.
Wow.
And dropping weight and whatever. So suddenly I get a call, and it's like, well, Paul wants to come see you. So I was laughing, you know, because I'm going, he wants to see if I'm sitting up here eating, you know, 3 billion calories and not working out and
right.
coming to check on me and stuff. So he came up and it was great. I'll never forget, there was this one moment that happened. Paul and I, you know, we played a game of racquetball. Now, I had never really played racquetball ever in my life. But I was like, you know, I've been working out for a month up there, and I'm moving good and everything. But Paul was a very good racquetball player, and we started to play. And he was having, you know, he was having trouble in terms of, you know, he was breathing hard, you know, with all that. But he was, you know, but he was, like, beating me. And I was watching the game, you know, and I'm sitting there, and I remember looking at him and thinking, my God, I just loved how badly he wants to beat me in this game,
yeah.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he just like, I mean, I and he did. The game was over, and I didn't, you know, I tried my best, you know, and played my hardest, you know.
Right.
And to win that game, and he won the game, you know, and I remember when it was over, I was like just looking at him like going, oh, my God, man, he just like, he had to beat me in that game. He had to be the man. And I was like, cool.
That laser focus, yeah, that intensity,
you know,
yeah.
And I remember looking at him and going, you want to play another? Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
So I can't let you go without asking you. You know, I am a diehard Pacino fanatic, and you recently had the opportunity to work with Pacino, and your collaboration with him finally comes out in April. It's 88 minutes. Tell me about the Pacino experience.
Well, I love Al. I'm with you guys. I mean, you know, I mean, coming up, there were the guys that blew my mind, and Al was one of them. You know. Of that generation. I got to work with Al years ago when I did Dick Tracy, and you know, and but of course it was kind of weird because I was never me on the set. I always had that strange head on, and you know,
right.
It's, you know, you
right.
spend six
right.
months with somebody, but you still like, you know, and you know, but just, you know, watching Al get into his thing, watching him go, watching where he comes from, you know, it was such a great experience back then. But this time when we got to work together, I really got to hang out with him more and really, just really, you know, I remember we would go out to dinner and we would rehearse while we were at dinner. And we were at this, like, really a very fancy Italian restaurant, and it was hysterical. They'd be, like, serving us food, and Al and I were rehearsing and just, you know, yelling at each other, and, you know. And the guys were like, no problem. They just would come around you and just hand you what you needed and, you know, kept going. And so, you know, that kind of an experience, you know. I mean, Al still cares, you know.
Yeah.
He cares. He wants it to be great, and, you know, and I do too, and all the guys that I love do. And, you know, when you work with people like that, you know, whenever you have the opportunity and you get to just go, you know.
Yeah.
It reminds me of what I got into it for. You know?
Right.
Because sometimes it's not like that. I mean, I always do. I come out like I want to do the best I can do. But, you know, it's not always, you know, where you feel like, wow, here I am. Everybody feels that way. And, you know, let's give it, you know. And Al's a great guy to boot. You know,
yeah,
good
yeah, you know, and that's what we respond to here on the show. You know, the passion the passion for the craft of what you do, and that's why we love you so much here on the
right.
show. And please come back and join us anytime you'd like in the future, Mr. Forsyth. You're welcome here anytime.
I'll bless
yes,
you guys.
Anytime.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you.
Great night.
Thank you so much, sir.
All right. Cheers.
Bye-bye, Dan.
Yes.
That is William Forsyth, a great actor, a very generous guy.
Yes. Okay, now I know this is about Traitor, but once again we have this testimony about Pacino's, you know, his character, his strengths, you know, his generosity.
Yeah.
Once again. I mean,
it's all the same. This is why I'm wondering why Pacino and Traitor haven't collaborated yet. It's all the same thing.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a laser focus, there's a dedication, your heart and your mind is intensely involved in this process. After 40 years, it doesn't matter how long you've been doing it. It's like your first day in class. I mean, you are completely consumed by it.
Right.
That's inspiring.
That's a good point. Why haven't they worked? That's interesting.
Why hasn't Scorsese and Pacino worked together? I mean,
it's really fun. It's got to happen soon. I mean, and I know it's been talked about. I know.
I would hope so. I know this isn't our next guest. I think it's the same caller that tried to call it earlier. I'm just going to try one more time in case I got it wrong last time.
Okay.
Was a prank. 703, you were on the air.
Yes, sir. I was under the understanding that Miss Dana Wells Delaney was supposed to be on your show tonight.
We're welcoming her in the next 9 minutes.
Oh, so can you talk to her? Will I be able to talk to her directly, or how? Does
sure,
she
sure. If you want to call in, I'll see this area code. And if you want to call in during that interview, it's going to start at the top of the hour, and it's going to run about 20 minutes. Now, I can't guarantee you that I can get you on right away, but if you hold maybe 10 or so minutes, I'll get you on, and you can ask a question, whatever you'd like.
All right. So she's going to be on what, 11?
Yeah,
11 Eastern. Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Bye bye. See, that wasn't a bad call.
No, that was fine. That was fine.
I heard Jason on the chat room. I could only peripherally pay attention to the chat room, but Jason said, it's a brave guy taking a phone call during the middle of a show. So, I guess so. We talked about hardcore. Hardcore is, for me, in his directorial resume. I mean, he's got great movies to his credit. Hardcore is the undiscovered gem to me. And that's why it was so great to hear Mr. Forsyth talk about it. Talk about a movie of contrast. You have George C. Scott as this ultra-conservative father, very strict.
Right.
And, you know, he's George C. Scott. His daughter turns up missing. One of his children turns up missing at a school trip. And he finds out that she has, he investigates, finds out that she's entered the world of hardcore underground pornography.
Right.
So he takes it upon himself to go undercover in that world to try to find her. Talk about dramatic contrast. I mean, first of all, any great screenwriter knows contrast and what makes great drama. And couple George C. Scott in that scenario, and it's electrifying.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of a whole trend of films, the father figure that he plays, George C. Scott, like in Rage, and even in, I think, what is it, The Savages, Lewis, he plays the father figure, but in Hardcore, it's the epitome. And
yeah.
In that film, people would, like we were talking a couple weeks ago, 8mm Traffic, they all modeled their storylines from Hardcore.
Absolutely. I want to play a clip from Hardcore. This
okay,
is a clip
good.
That takes place when he hires a PI to find his daughter. The PI uncovers a roll of film that his daughter is the, you know, so-called star of. And it's one of these underground pornography films.
Okay.
And George C. Scott sits in a darkened, seedy little theater and watches it for the first time. This is to give you a sense of the intensity and just Schrader as an artist that will not look away.
Right.
You know, that's him in a nutshell. Here's a clip from Hardcore.
Turn it off.
Man.
Yeah, I mean, I remember that scene.
It's one of the great scenes. Yeah. I'm sorry. I'm getting teared up just to see that.
That's okay. That shows you how effective it is. That's the point of the show.
Heartbreaking.
Yeah, I mean, that's the point of the show, the reach of these films. And like you said, it isn't, you know, I guess we know the film, and I remember actually watching it on TV a long time ago. I probably wasn't supposed to watch it, although no one put these rules in at this house. But
yeah.
I remember watching it on, like, one of our syndicated channels, I guess in the early 80s.
I found it through Netflix.
Dude, those early ones especially that he directed.
Yeah, if you haven't seen Hardcore, find it. Find it on Netflix. That's my major flick pick. If you don't settle for 8mm, which is an insulting, it's effective in its own right. But
no, it's just insulting.
It's insulting how much it steals from Hardcore without crediting Hardcore.
You know, it steals tremendously from Hardcore. I mean, there's no doubt about that.
Yeah. Let's talk about Gigolo, American Gigolo, which is probably the first, as a director, the first big commercial hit he had.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
And it really picked up a zeitgeist of the moment. You know, it's a very 80s movie. It has that feeling to it. It's about a male, I guess you could say, prostitute, but up for an upscale kind of clientele.
Right. It's the quintessential 80s movie.
Richard Gere a big star.
It made him a big star, and I guess it's the first of this trilogy, you know, that would continue in Light Sleeper and conclude in The Walker, which came out last year with Woody Harrelson.
Right.
And you could also put Autofocus in there as well.
He claims that it's his Lonely Man trilogy.
Yeah. Okay, well, then
I see so much of that in, you know, obviously he includes in the trilogy, he includes Gigolo, Light Sleeper, The Walker.
Right.
I see it in so many. What is Taxi Driver if not that?
Yeah, Taxi Driver, Bringing Out the Dead.
There's something about his
Raging Bull.
His consummation with male loneliness and neediness, the inability to express tenderness and experience love. There's a lot of that in all these movies.
Affliction.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. And we're going to play Affliction a little bit later and talk about it before we bring on Mr. Goldblum. Affliction is just like that. And I remember hearing an interview with him, and he said Affliction is about male violence.
Mm-hmm.
Our not wanting to repeat the sins of our father, but ultimately we go down that road.
And we
have to destroy it in order to exorcise it from ourselves.
And isn't that kind of, though, going back to what we talked about on the phone before that, linking Schrader with the other filmmakers of the 70s, isn't that essentially also Coppola's and The Godfather? Michael does become a man like his father. He says he won't, but he does.
Right.
So there's a constant theme with the filmmakers of the 70s. There is this theme of fathers and sons and brothers, sibling rivalries, if you will. And Schrader is sort of, I think, the epitome, the more I think about, of all those themes.
Yeah. I'm looking at the chat room. You're absolutely right. I'm looking at the chat room. Thanks, everyone, for joining us tonight in the chat room. If you have any questions for Ms. Delaney, unfortunately, Mr. Goldblum is pre-recorded. So you can always submit questions for Mr. Goldblum. If you like, go at it. But a wonderful interview with Mr. Goldblum. And we're expecting Ms. Delaney at the top of the hour. People are kind of wondering if this caller, if it will be an inappropriate question.
And Jason O'Brien says that a male prostitute's his dream job. Okay, yeah. I mean, I'm there. Sure.
Yeah. We haven't talked about American Gigolo. We kind of opened it up. I just watched it again last week. A few things caught me.
How young everyone was the first thing that
caught me. You can't get over that. And plus, the Schrader's been quoted as saying that he wants to upset people. He said, "I want to fuck with their heads."
Mm-hmm.
He is a provocateur. This is a very provocative storyline.
And especially at that time.
Yeah, very provocative. And something new that we haven't seen explored before, really. Richard Gere is our way into it. Very attractive, very effortless. I mean, he's Richard Gere.
Right.
There's something that I want to explore with Ms. Delaney, his portrayal of women, because we think of him like we think of Scorsese, possibly.
right.
as a predominantly male, you know, he's very strong with the male characters. They kind of overpower everything else on the screen. So when a light sleeper or Patty Hearst comes around, what that dynamic is like, you know, that's an interesting thing to explore.
Yeah, I mean, he doesn't even light a day, Joan Jett,
or Lauren Bacall and Gigolo.
Yeah.
There's something very odd, though.
Yeah,
I don't know if you recall it at the end of Gigolo.
Lauren Hutton, you mean? Lauren?
Lauren Hutton, yeah. What'd I say?
Lauren Bacall.
I'm sorry. Lauren
That's
McCall's
okay, dude. That's okay. That's all right.
Yeah. There's something interesting at the end of Gigolo. It's very slick, the film.
Oh, it's slick. That is where you look at the dictionary, you see American Gigolo. I'm sorry.
Yeah, but the end of it, if you recall the last maybe 10 minutes of it from the time he gets incarcerated,
mm-hmm.
Lauren Hutton gets him out.
Yeah.
Gives him an alibi. He gets out, you know. It's done in all fade-outs.
Mm-hmm, yes.
Which is uncharacteristic of the rest of the film.
True.
And it almost seems like if it were done by anyone else, I would think that it would be amateurish. But there has to be, I hate to say that, because knowing the Schrader's the artist that he is, it can't be just an accident that he decided to fade out. It's almost like it turns into like Cliff Note kind of fragments at the end of it.
Right, yeah. I got that impression too.
Yeah, isn't that odd?
Yes, it is.
And I hate to say that I don't understand it.
Right. No. it's really weird. It's such an I can't believe Olivia. Someone brought up Richard Gere and gerbils in the same sentence, and I thought I would be the one to do that, but I'm really shocked that it was Olivia.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
I'm sorry.
Richard Gere. I think he's grown so far above that rumor, whatever that is. But, I mean, he's a fantastic actor, and he really came into his own in American Gigolo.
Yes, he did.
but I thought that was a stylistic choice I'd love to ask him about.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Yeah. But it's an undeniably great film, undeniably great soundtrack. I mean, Blondie's Call Me
is
a major fixture.
That, and here's the thing. In 2008, I have to say it holds up pretty well.
Oh, yeah.
I think it holds up very well, much better than a lot of people give it credit for. I have to say that really does hold up very well.
I think you can absolutely, you know, The Walker has not yet appeared in an area close to me, but I think it's released on wide on DVD next month.
Yeah, I think actually either the end of April or beginning of May.
Yeah, and I would think that it would be a perfect double bill with The Walker. Knowing the story of The Walker, you know, Woody Harrelson plays this gay.
He's an escort. He
yeah.
He's a male escort for very
Washington elite.
Washington elite wives, and it does seem to. It has a lot of echoes of Gigolo, and it was very interesting when that came. Unfortunately, it did not play that long here, but. You know, it was very interesting because people did say, it was, it has a lot of the themes, and it almost feels like an 80s film, was as one critic put it. So I'm very curious to see it because I think Woody Harrelson in a Paul Schrader film is a very tempting idea. I'd really like to see that.
Yeah, and he's great with casting, like we said before.
Oh, yeah, very much
Woody,
so.
Woody Harrelson, just a fantastic actor. And we're going to talk about, I think he has the perfect family. You know, it's very tricky when you're casting family in a movie. And we talked about Joan Jett and Michael J. Fox for Light of Day. Talk about the perfect father-son casting in a film, Affliction.
Yeah.
Could you get any more, any greater than Nick Nolte and James Coburn
as
father incredible. And son?
That was incredible.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Perfect. Inspired. Our next guest is up and ready to go. This is very, very exciting for so many of us.
I think the whole entire chat room is going nuts.
Yeah, they're buzzing big time in there. We're honored to welcome our next guest to the show tonight, an extraordinarily gifted actress who's given exceptional and haunting performances in two of Schrader's most challenging works, Patty Hearst and Light Sleeper. Her resume also includes fantastic work in films like House Sitter, Moon Over Parador, Tombstone, Fly Away Home, and landmark television series like Magnum P.I., Justice League, The L Word, Battlestar Galactica, Jerry, you were talking about that.
Yeah,
earlier.
Oh yeah.
And of course, the show that initially launched her career into the stratosphere, China Beach, for which she received 2 Emmy nominations and 2 Emmy wins for Best Actress. She's currently heating up the small screen again with her recent role of Catherine Mayfair in the television phenomenon Desperate Housewives. And Jerry, I know you watch that every week.
You know, I did. I really
I know,
did.
I know you do. I know you do. Admit it, my friend. Guilty pleasure. It is a great joy to welcome Dana Delaney to our program. Ms. Delaney, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Good evening.
Good evening.
Thank
welcome.
You so much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Oh, this is a great treat for us.
Thank you.
This seems like a great time for you. I mean, I look on the cover of Entertainment Weekly magazine, and there you are, and you have this great new role in Desperate Housewives. Is this an exciting time?
It is nice. You know, I've never stopped working. You just sort of go in waves, and this is sort of a little bit of a crest right now.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Well, tell me about that set, working on that show. Is that a lively, fun set?
Yeah, it is fun. I mean, it's very much its own world, and that took a little getting used to at first because it's this strange hybrid of soap opera and sitcom that
right.
I think it's really the first time that anybody's really been able to pull off that tone and make it last. And I think
yeah.
that Mark Cherry has some kind of savant thing going there. I don't even begin to understand it.
But I would think that it would have to be at first, because you know that's for all intents and purposes it's a family that's existed for several years already.
Mm-hmm.
Have to be a little intimidating to kind of walk into that and try to become acclimated with that.
Yeah, I just sort of think of it as work, and so I kind of keep my head down, do my job, concentrate, and then hopefully the rest will follow. And
right.
It has. Everybody, you know, at first, understandably, everybody was kind of like, you know, why do we need another cast member? It's already so big.
Mm.
But now it's been great. I just sort of feel like I'm part of the family.
Now, you did quite a bit of TV and a few films before your first collaboration with Mr. Schrader,
mm-hmm.
with Patty Hearst. Was there an audition process for Patty Hearst? What was that experience like?
It's funny. Yeah, I met with Paul on that, and I had long hair, and he said to me, would you cut your hair off for the movie? Because, you know, the original Angela Atwood, which was not her real name. I'm trying to remember. It was Angela something. Anyway, she had this bob. I said, yeah, sure. So that was the origin of my bob, was because Angela had one.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the middle of shooting Patty Hearst, I got cast in China Beach.
Mm.
So I was shooting the pilot of China Beach and Patty Hearst simultaneously, so that's why I ended up having that bob for China Beach, was mm. Patty Hearst.
Oh, wow. So what? I'm sure you knew about Schrader's work prior to working with him.
Yes.
Yes. What surprised you about him? Because obviously his work, just judging on his work, you expect this incredibly intense person. Is that mm-hmm. pretty much what you found on set?
Yeah, I mean, Paul is intense. There's nobody like Paul. He is truly an auteur, you know, and there's not many of those left.
Yeah.
He has a vision. And it's very clear what he wants from top to bottom. You know, he oversees everything. He's such a visual person, especially for somebody who, you know, is an intellectual. It's interesting to have that mix. So the look is important to him. And, yeah, he is intense, you know. He's what I imagined when I was starting acting, what a film director should be.
Yeah. But how exactly does he direct? I mean, you've worked with him twice now.
Yeah. Well, the first time it was just terrifying because he's so smart. And, you know, he expects a lot. He gave us all a lot of research about the period during the Patty Hearst movie.
Right.
We all had a lot of books to read. And then we all went up to San Francisco. I don't know if you know all this, but we went up to San Francisco and all the people cast of the SLA, including Natasha Richardson, who was playing Patty.
Right.
And we lived in this horrible apartment in San Francisco. We were supposed to pretend we were the SLA for a week.
Right.
And sleep
you know, we just spoke to William Forsythe.
Oh, well, Bill could tell you, yeah.
Yeah, and he started telling us. He could tell us a little bit more about that. How did that help you as an actor? I would think that would be invaluable.
Well, did he tell you how long we lasted doing it?
No.
I think it was 2 days. I mean, we were all supposed to take turns cooking and do all this stuff and, you know, dress in our cross-dressing outfits and all. And by the end, it was so funny because Natasha was the only one of us who really cooked, and she sort of became the mother hen of all of us.
Oh, wow.
And then we couldn't really deal with it. We all ended up staying in some crappy motel instead. We were
light,
too spoiled.
Light Sleeper was another just fantastic
yes.
role. Tell us, for our audience who aren't aware, tell us a little bit about that film and the character you play.
Well, that was what was great for me was it was sort of Paul was my bookend because before I did China Beach, I did Patty Hearst, and then my first movie after China Beach was Light Sleeper.
Right.
And it was so nice to go back to Paul because, that's part of his trilogy of The Loner, The American Gigolo, and...
The Walker, I think, was the third.
Was the third one.
Yeah, the third one.
Yeah, and he, again, was great. It was such a beautifully written role. It was just beautifully written from beginning to end. Nothing changed. It was just as scripted. Nothing ever changes in Paul's scripts because they're
yeah.
so pure.
Oh, yeah.
And, again, he knows exactly what he wants. And I just remember him saying to me, and he kind of will screw with you. You know, he likes to mess with you a little bit. He likes to play with your head.
I can imagine that.
And you know, just like, this is how I thought directors would be, those little games that they play. And he's from that old-time school of doing that, of trying to
right.
psychological games with you. And I remember he took me out to dinner after a couple of days of shooting Light Sleeper. And Paul likes to drink wine, and I like to drink wine. So we were having our wine and talking, and he said, you know, it's not like television. He said, you've been doing television for a long time now. He says, you don't have to do the same thing in every take.
Right.
And I was so insulted because I didn't think I was doing the same thing.
Right, right. Oh, my.
I mean, that is the worst thing you can say to an actor because he's just basically saying you're a hack.
This is something that we've heard about him, though, that he is very blunt.
Yes.
Straightforward.
He'll tell you what's on his mind.
Yes, and also I think he was really screwing with me, too, because he knew that would upset me.
Right,
and
right, put you on edge. Yeah.
Yeah, because I always thought of myself as so inventive. So it was great, because believe me, the next time I went to the set, I was trying everything possible.
Well, he strikes me as one of those directors that you can take those chances with, and you can explore different directions for a character, you know.
Yeah.
Did you consider these like major risky roles for you? I mean, did you feel like you were taking risks with these characters?
No, not really, because I actually have a sensibility a lot like Paul's. I mean, the darker, the better for me. I love that. I love going there, and so I felt really at home working with him. It felt very natural for me.
This is something that's very, very interesting to me because we think of Paul Schrader and we think, like you said, the lonely man, the outsider. We always think of the strong male presence in his films. So with something like Patty Hearst and Light Sleeper, what does that tell us about his understanding and his portrayal of women?
I think, the thing that people probably don't realize about Paul is what a huge heart he has. He's extremely sentimental. And I think he doesn't really like to show that a lot. But he's a very, very kind person, really, at heart, and very, very sensitive.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, especially in Light Sleeper, the character that Susan Sarandon played,
mm-hmm.
it's just heartbreaking. The whole movie is heartbreaking.
Oh, yeah.
To me. And then my character, Marianne, I mean, that journey that she takes from getting her life together to just at the end, you know, you just know she's just not going to make it.
Right.
It's sad, and I think Paul relates to that kind of thing as a human being of the demons inside. He, you know, he's got his own demons like we all do.
Yeah.
I have a question from the chat room, actually.
Yeah, go ahead.
Does he allow for any improv on the set?
We definitely, when we did Patty Hearst, there was improv.
Right.
But not so much on Light Sleeper because it was such a tight script.
Mm-hmm.
So not, I don't remember doing a lot in
okay.
that.
I mean, you've been acting for quite some time now. How rare is it to get a script like that really, I mean, it's all on the page.
very rare, especially these days.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't know how spoiled I was, you know, that I got to start out doing something like that.
Mm.
Yeah.
We interviewed Jeff Goldblum about his collaboration with Mr. Schrader, and he said that Schrader is a wonderful kind of raconteur as well, that he's an excellent storyteller of Hollywood and his dealings with Hollywood. Do you recall any kind of stories with your time with him?
Yes, there are many, many stories. Most of them you can't say.
Actually, this is uncensored radio. You can say whatever you want.
You can say whatever you want.
You
can say whatever you want.
You know, I can't remember specifically. I'm sorry. But it's just Paul himself is such a character.
Right.
I mean, that's what I remember, just hanging out with him, because he will always put his own foot in his mouth. Because that's what I mean. He's so endearing, because on one hand, he's such an intellectual, so smart, and such a, you know, an encyclopedia of film knowledge.
Mm.
And yet, he will always offend somebody somehow with what he says.
That's great. He's provocateur. It's,
yeah.
It's wonderful. And again, he's working with Willem Dafoe in Light Sleeper as well, who you obviously acted opposite of in the film.
Mm-hmm.
And they've collaborated many times. He almost seems to be, in a sense, you know, Schrader's muse.
Yeah, no, it's true. And
what,
I think
what,
part of that is because Willem is such a lovely man. You know, he's also got that dichotomy going, because his exterior is so extraordinary looking and
yeah.
sometimes frightening. And yet inside, he's just the softest creature. And somehow that works, you know, the contrast of that.
He even said that he likes Willem when he is vulnerable. Most people use him for, you know, the tough villain, but he enjoys the vulnerability of Willem Dafoe.
Oh, he was so vulnerable in Light Sleeper.
And also autofocus, too. I mean,
Yes. I loved autofocus.
Yeah.
I thought
yeah.
that was great. I mean, think of the look of that film. It so captured that period.
Yeah.
It's rare to get a director these days who writes and directs and also creates a world unto himself, and Paul is one of the few left that still does that.
Right.
Absolutely. We have a phone call. We have a caller. Let's see if we can pick it up, see if this is a question for you here on the line. 703, you're on the air. Go right ahead.
Hello, Miss Dana.
Hello.
I've been following your career with great interest for a long time. My name is Michael from the beautiful state of Virginia.
Oh, hi, Michael.
Happy belated birthday. You get better with age.
Thank you.
Are you done shooting Desperate Housewives, or is it still going on?
We have, let's see, we're just starting episode 14. We have 3 more to go.
I'm sorry I missed being able to get to New York last year to see you on stage.
Oh, yes. I had a great time doing it. I did this Neil LaBute play last fall off-Broadway called Things We Said Today that was really fun to do.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he's another... You know what? I see a lot of similarity between Neil and Paul.
I do, too. Now that you mentioned
yeah,
that, I was going to bring that up. Thank you, by the way, Michael, for calling in.
Thank you, Michael.
Yeah, tell me about that similarity you see.
Well, again, it's funny, I'd never really thought about it before.
But it's there.
It's there. They're both really smart and extremely, words, you know, great with the script, and yet also really sensitive with their direction. And Neil also creates his own world, you know, it's his own world view that you get. And you always know when you see a Neil LaBute piece, and you know when you see a, you know, Paul Schrader piece.
That's very true.
And they're also the same thing. They've got this dichotomy going where on the outside, I think they scare people.
Right.
But on the inside, they're the sweetest men. They really are. And I don't think people get to see that side to them that often.
I would say it's really true with Neil LaBute.
Yeah, very much so. And you know, they're not afraid to explore the extremes.
Yeah. I mean, and a lot of it has to do with male, female, you know, issues. And I think they've both been accused of misogyny. And I think it's unfair on both counts.
Yeah. So how do you place these two in the scope of your career, if you're able to be objective about your own career? How do you place these two collaborations with Schrader?
I would still say to this day that Light Sleeper is my favorite movie that I've done.
Mm-hmm.
And it's too bad that it was so early in my career.
Well, that's, it hasn't been all downhill since Light Sleeper.
No, but in terms of sensibility, my personal sensibility, that was the closest to it.
Yeah. At the same time, I know you have several films on the horizon.
Mm-hmm.
You have, I think, like 4 films awaiting release. Would you like to tell us about some of those?
Well, you know, it's this world of indie filmmaking, and
right.
you do them, and you hope for the best, and then you see what happens, and they're all very different. One in particular that I liked was called Multiple Sarcasms. That's with Tim Hutton and Mira Sorvino, that a guy named Brooks Branch directed. It's his first movie. He wrote it and directed it, and one of the things that's fun about it is it's very much in that 70s vein of movies like Starting Over and Paul Mazursky and
mm-hmm.
those kind of movies, Pakula.
He's got quite a cast.
Yeah, and he really, I think, captures the feeling of that period, which was a great period for filmmaking, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So just to end on a Schrader question, what do you think his identity is in film? What is his legacy?
Well, I mean, obviously he'll always be known as the man who wrote Raging Bull and Taxi Driver.
Right.
I mean, those, and also, you know, Last Temptation of Christ, the Scorsese connection will always be there.
Yeah, that's for sure.
But I think for him himself, as a director, I think that he will be very unique and sort of part of a dying breed of director, which makes
sadly,
me sad.
Sadly so, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm afraid you're right.
Yeah, we're talking about this with our first guest tonight, that it's very sad and very telling that someone like Paul Schrader has to work 3 or 4 years in between films just to raise financing for the next one.
It just pains me to see what he goes through now in terms of trying to work within the system.
Yeah.
You know, because, I mean, he was doing those movies that now we would call indie movies, but back then, you know, the studios paid for them.
Right.
And it pains me to see him go through what he has to go through now to get a script made.
Well, especially, I think he said in an interview himself that Autofocus and Affliction, they didn't lose money. They made money.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But not the kind of money that automatically allows them to start up another one with their finances.
Yeah. And they just provided great roles for actors.
Oh, they're amazing.
Each time out of the gate, it does.
Yeah, I mean, just to see James Coburn like that, ugh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Killed me.
Oh, absolutely.
Killed me, and what a great role, you know, for him to end his career mm-hmm. on.
Yeah.
And the
yeah.
same thing to see Greg Kinnear play a part like that.
Well, I think that's really the changing point for Greg Kinnear. It's after that he starts to get the more darker, more serious
mm-hmm.
parts, The Matador,
mm-hmm.
Little Miss Sunshine, even just
yeah.
things outside his comfort area.
Yeah, and also, you know, it's funny, because he was in that Neil LaBute movie, Nurse Betty.
That's right.
Yes,
And he was great in that.
He was.
There's the LaBute connection again.
Yeah.
And there's something interesting to me about the how fascinated he is with the contrast. I mean, you see it with a movie like Hardcore, which we mentioned before you came on,
mm-hmm.
and certainly with Autofocus, there's something about, I think he enjoys exploring a character acting in a way that is the complete opposite of what's in his best interest, what he knows to be in his best interest.
Well, first of all, that's great drama right there,
yes.
and
mm-hmm,
he's smart
right.
at that. But, you know, you can't ignore Paul's upbringing. It's his own internal struggle,
right.
being raised a Calvinist in Michigan, and yet at heart, I mean, he's such a I wouldn't say a hedonist, but he's he enjoys life, you know. He lives it fully, and he has great taste and appetite, and they, you know, they wouldn't be that extreme, be held in such extreme if he wasn't told he couldn't do things as a kid.
Right.
Well, Ms. Delaney, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank
great
you.
Great pleasure.
It was fun.
And we love you here on the show. Please come back and join us anytime.
Yeah,
right, thank you.
Thank
Bye.
You.
Thank you so much. That is Dana Delaney. She's currently on, you know, one of the biggest TV hits of
yeah,
all time,
I mean, she's on one
Desperate
of the
Housewives.
Biggest shows ever.
The cover of Entertainment Weekly, a major star, and just a dynamic actress. And if you want to know just how dynamic, there's no better examples than her work with Schrader. Just it's right there. Light Sleeper, Patty Hearst.
Yeah, I mean
actors, you know. actor's dream to work with Schrader.
Yeah, and we made a great connection tonight between Paul Schrader and Neil LaBute. I never even thought about that, and it's a very telling connection right there. There is a link in their
Absolutely.
Work.
Jeff Goldblum in about 10 minutes.
Okay, speaking of...
Close off the show with the bloomer.
Yeah, before we get to that, Jason O'Brien claims that you failed on the 703.
Oh, so, come on. No.
I thought you ended the world, because I was very nervous about that.
He brought up like two or three points. He asked a question in there and brought up 2 points.
Got the whole thing about Dana Delaney doing the Neil LaBute play, so it was able to get us to that. So
you got to make the conversation flow, and I'm glad that we had the opportunity to get a fan in there to speak to Mr. Delaney himself, and
that's
always
right.
Nice. And we don't always trust that, you know, there's no advanced screening here. As
yeah, we don't have that kind of budget where we can screen.
Yeah, so we never know when someone's going to have a voice box to disguise their voice or if they're wearing a panty on their head or something. We don't know. So, but that was great to, thank you, 703 caller. I think his name was Michael for calling in. And we're glad we could get you on the show tonight.
That was good. No, that was.
So some more kind of films. We mentioned Affliction and the perfect casting, James Coburn opposite Nick Nolte.
And led to another before Mr. Coburn passed away. Wasn't The Man from Elysian Fields with Andy Garcia?
That was
a great, great role for him.
A great kind of underground movie that very few people are aware of.
Yeah.
They're going in the... chat room about Miss Delaney, and everybody's crazy about her.
You were right this morning when you emailed me and said this is our biggest show, and it is.
Yeah.
It is our biggest.
Such a beautiful actress, and just luminescent.
She is. Very down to earth.
Yeah, which is great. And a real artist. We have a couple more clips I'd like to play here.
Oh, please do.
We're talking about Affliction. Affliction, I think, cannot be ignored. It's one of the great films in his resume.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like Nick Nolte. Talk about the perfect Schrader actor.
Mm-hmm. He is.
Someone that bleeds intensity know, from every pore. That's Nick Nolte. And it's a great movie about fathers and sons and the burdens they pass off to their children. And not living up to your full potential and the repercussions of that. And all the themes that we're talking about, the inability to express tenderness and love and awkward relationships with women and dealing with male violent nature and that sort of thing. It's all in this
all
film
there.
In spades. Yeah, and here's a clip from Affliction. The mother of the family has died. This is about halfway through the film. And the family convenes... In a bar it takes place.
Right.
And it's they want to put on some kind of mini service, like just make one up real quick, and tensions follow to give you a sense of this family structure and Affliction. Here's a scene from Affliction.
We come to thee on our knees today, begging for thy forgiveness, and thanking thee for the undeserved gift of thy salvation. We thank thee whose blood was shed that we may live.
Praise the Lord.
Oh, not me with a single hair in every woman's head.
Please look down upon this woman, our mother and friend, and make her example known to us.
That one of you is with the goddamn hair in that good woman's head. Dave! Why is this?
I think head on to the church.
This is a difficult time. Emotional.
Pop, it's no big deal.
Oh, come on. Smart guy, tell me it's no big deal. Tell me that there's a single one of you that's worth one single hair on that woman's gray head. Tell me that. What?
Jesus is more powerful than any demon.
Oh, go yourself. Go on, wait.
Just leave.
Oh, yeah, just listen to your little brother here. Wait, just leave it.
Candy has it. All of you. I like that for children. Jesus freaks and candy ass.
The strength of the writing there, too.
Right.
Incredibly intense movie. Man, we're playing these clips, and every time we play the clips, the clips end, and we're so like hushed, you know.
Yeah.
It doesn't get more intense than these films, and more involving.
Yeah, so they're very intense
and dynamic. Here's another clip from one of his latest films. You know, this is autofocus. It's the story of Bob Crane, who was the star of Hogan's Heroes.
That's right.
Very beloved, very clean cut, as it would appear to fans on TV. Actor.
And he was anything but that.
Yeah, the star of Hogan's Heroes came into millions of homes every week, and he was very beloved. Sold himself as a very kind of normal all-American family man. And actually, he befriended a man named John Carpenter. And John Carpenter was into surveillance and electronics and that sort of thing.
Right.
And by forming this relationship, they started to videotape sex orgies. It started to get deeper and deeper. And all the while, Bob Crane is trying to maintain his career, maintain his all-American image, and it's crumbling apart around him. That duality, again, that we see explored in the Schrader film is front and center in autofocus. And as anyone that probably knows anything about Bob Crane, he was murdered. I think he was bludgeoned to death by probably a tripod or something. And the case is yet to be. I mean, it's yet to be prosecuted. I mean, Carpenter went up on charges, but he was those charges were dropped, right?
I think so.
Yeah, I think they were. It's another great Willem Dafoe performance in a Schrader film as well.
Yeah.
Greg Kinnear is a revelation in this film. And here's just a brief clip from Autofocus, which is now available on DVD.
There could be a very serious conflict here between your lifestyle and your career.
How many women are there? How many?
Thinking about getting out.
Well, we got a good thing going, Big Daddy.
Why ruin it?
Bob Crane is a good guy. Bob Crane's a loser.
I don't know about you guys. I got things to hide.
Yeah. It's all right there. Bob Crane is a good guy. Bob Crane is a
loser. And it's quite a performance from Greg Kinnear, and he really gets into character in this film.
He gets it. Yeah.
Yeah.
He gets it. And that's why he's a great actor. We thank Dana Delaney, William Forsythe, Thomas G. Waits. Could we have asked for a better lineup of guests tonight?
No, we couldn't. It was this was the best we've done after 1 year. I mean, this is incredible.
Yeah, and we are celebrating our one-year anniversary, April 16th. It's going to be a special two-hour show. It's going to be a great one. We're going to give away lots of stuff. We're going to play loads of clips, great clips. You wouldn't believe these clips we have. A lot of funny, insightful, revealing stuff. If you've missed any of the 180 interviews we've done in the past year,
God, I'm not
exaggerating, 180 interviews plus. Then you're going to get little snippets of a lot of the best of them. Of course, De Palma and Howard Shore and Joey Pants and Philip Baker Hall and great filmmakers. But even the people behind the scenes, the screenwriters who have the scoop on the cast members that were originally chosen for certain roles.
And Kelly Masterson. I mean,
Great people. And you wouldn't believe some of the stuff. I forgot going back through the archives. Some of the great stuff that's revealed. Amongst this past year of guests.
Right.
It's like, man, that was gold. That was gold what we had right there. So we're looking forward to that. We're probably going to take a lot of time off, a couple of weeks off, prior to that show to prepare it. It's just that special and important to us. As is Mr. Schrader, and we feel so honored as just regular movie fans to be able to express our appreciation for the artists that make a difference in our lives, and we know countless others. And we could not have asked for more generous, talented group of people joining us tonight, not the least of which is Mr. Jeff Goldblum, who I had the honor of speaking to several weeks ago. He is currently in London. He's doing a production of Speed the Plow with Kevin Spacey at the Old Vic Theater. So he couldn't make the live broadcast because it's like 4 or 5 a.m. his time where he is. But we wanted to close the show on his interview tonight because, first of all, he's very articulate about Mr. Schrader. And he speaks to what's upcoming in Mr. Schrader's career. This is a film, their first time collaborating together. It's called Adam Resurrected. It's every bit, if not more, challenging than material than he's ever tackled before. And it really speaks to an artist's drive to keep exploring. to never stop, you know. And we were honored to have Mr. Goldblum join us. I put this interview up at 150% just to make sure that everyone can hear it without adjusting your volume, so hopefully it's not too loud. And I'm telling you, there's women in the chat room, their heart's pounding because Goldblum, they're about to hear him. As a straight man, I'm listening to Goldblum, and I melt a little bit. there's something about this man's voice. And Jerry, you haven't heard this interview yet.
So this will be great
for both of us. I will put us on mute until it's over. And ladies and gentlemen, enjoy Jeff Goldblum. The movie geeks are honored to welcome to our program one of our great artists, an actor whose tremendously versatile roster of performances in film, stage, and television never fail to inspire, move, or surprise us. His extensive credits include searing performances in Invasion of the Body Snatchers, The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai, The Big Chill, Silverado, Jurassic Park, Independence Day, Igby Goes Down, The Life Aquatic, Fay Grimm, and of course, David Cronenberg's The Fly, in which he delivered a one-of-a-kind performance, beautifully modulated between the horrifying and the heartbreaking. His barely contained enthusiasm for the art of acting is always apparent and deeply infectious, as it was with my favorite film of last year, The Delightful Pittsburgh. But he is also never fearful of tackling a role that takes him to the darkest realms of humanity. His latest work in Paul Schrader's Adam Resurrected certainly sounds like such an exploration. It is a great delight that I introduce to the show one of our greatest actors and one of our greatest inspirations, Mr. Jeff Goldblum. Mr. Goldblum, hello.
Jamie, hi, how are you? Thank you so much. That you're too kind. That's very, very sweet of you.
Well, thank you so much. I want to start out, I want to do the slobbering fan thing right off the bat, because we speak for hours on end every week on the show about our love of cinema, and you keep coming back up, and particularly with your work in The Fly. I just think it is one of the most astonishing performances I've ever witnessed.
Thank you so much. Well, it was fun and challenging to do, and David Cronenberg, of course, is largely responsible. He's a wonderful director and a great fellow. Have you ever talked to him?
Not yet. We actually had the honor of speaking with Howard Shore, and he's mounting the opera for The Fly right now.
Oh yeah, I've heard rumors about that. What are they? They're doing an opera of it, huh?
I think they're probably pretty close to premiere time on that.
How about that? That
I know it's amazing, and I also have to tell you that I got a chance to see Pittsburgh last year, like I said in the intro. It is the most delightful movie I think I've ever seen. I was grinning ear to ear from start to finish.
Oh, you're so nice. Thank you. Well, it's special to me. You know, we cooked it up over several years, you know, even though it's a very modest little handcrafted thing, and I got a big kick out of it myself.
Yeah, well, that's. I promise no more oogly, slobbering fan stuff from here on out. I got that out of the way.
Thank you, you're
calling us all the way from London. I appreciate it so much. You're in the middle of a run of David Mamet's Speed the Plow at the Old Vic with Kevin Spacey. That sounds like a dream.
It's a dream project. It's really fun. Do you know this play, Speed the Plow?
I know it, kind of. I'm very familiar with Mamet, but not particularly this play.
Yeah, it's about a couple of, you know, Hollywood business types, you know, movie makers in the late 80s, you know, a head of a studio and a producer, who gets exposed to spiritual wisdom material through an encounter with this girl over the course of a night, and thinks his whole life has changed, but we see in the end that there are two guys on the far reaches of idiocy and egotism and materialism, and it doesn't exactly take, at least not yet.
I think you've been doing this since live performances since early February, and you're running till the end of April. Do you find, given this caliber of writing and the caliber of talent you're acting across from, do you find that you're still discovering things constantly?
Yeah, totally. It's like a continuing workshop and graduate project and rehearsal period. We fill the theater every night. 1,000 people watch us as we keep exploring this stuff. It's very rich and interesting material. To me, it is, and I keep trying to get better.
I can't imagine how great that show is. So the real reason why you're here to help us pay tribute to Mr. Paul Schrader.
I sure am. I adore him.
And you had the pleasure of working with him on his upcoming film, Adam Resurrected. But before this collaboration came about, were there works of his that you were particularly taken by?
Yes. He was a writer on Raging Bull, of course, as we know, and Taxi Driver and Last Temptation of Christ, and I loved all of those. And then saw all of his movies that he'd done. I loved Affliction, you know, in recent years. Autofocus I really liked. He's just done his whole body of work is so impressive. He's just always adventurous, risky, and smart, and obviously high integrity.
I think that's what I respond to most with him, because he's not afraid of going to the darkest places.
Yeah.
And he doesn't shy away from ambiguity, and he's fearless. He's one of our true fearless artists.
I think so too. He's an inspiration to me. I think he really is an artist and very brave. And this material was, I think, very challenging and delicious, but a kind of a high wire attempt. And it needed all of his interest in things dark and ambiguous, like you say.
So
and I think he pulled it off. I really enjoyed it.
Did he approach you with this project? How did that come about?
Yeah, he did. You know, there's a producer, Israeli producer, and it was co-produced with some German producers. But this Israeli fella, Ehud Blyberg, it had been a passion for him for a couple of decades, taken from a book by Yoram Kaniuk called Adam Resurrected. And he'd been trying to get the rights and gone through many little dramas about it over the years, and had finally latched onto Paul Schrader. And Paul read it, and apparently told him that he thought I was the one to play the part, and so they approached me. That's right.
Mm. Well, you have said that it's the most challenging and the juiciest part you've ever had on film. Could you tell our audience a little bit more about the plot of the film and the character you play in it?
Sure. It takes place in Israel in 1961-62, roughly, in a mental institution, rehabilitation center, kind of that employs innovative therapies of one kind or another, exclusively for concentration camp survivors. Now that we've been finished with the war for, 15, 16 years since 45. And so we're all there, and we meet me there, and through some flashbacks find out that I was a kind of a star entertainer in Berlin early on, Jewish, and I had a couple of daughters and a wife. I did animal impersonations, and I was a gifted mind reader and a terrific violinist and kind of a big star in Berlin. And Willem Dafoe comes to one of my shows we see back in the 30s, and he's a kind of a sad, crazy character. And I do some mind reading and figure out that he's going to kill himself that very night. And through kind of including him in this bit, I expose it, but kind of laugh him out of it and kind of save his life. Years later, it turns out when we show up at this extermination camp, when we get off the train, he says, "Oh, Adam Stein, you're the funniest man in all of Germany. You should have seen him. He could do any kind of animal there. Here, for my dog Rex, here, do an animal impersonation. Do a dog." So I get down on my hands and knees in order to, you know, leverage the safety of my family, and do a dog, and he laughs. He says, "That's funny." He says, "Take him to my barracks," and he makes me be a dog, living in the dog pen and eating from the dog bowl and living in outside and living in the doghouse with his dog for the remaining year and a half that I'm there. I lose my family, as it turns out, and the camp gets liberated, but by that time I'm in a horrible mess, and I've lost my mind. So when I find my way years later to Israel and to this mental institution, one of the things I tell them is that they could never have dogs there. That's one thing I can't stand to be around. I can't stand to. And then I hear a dog barking from a room, and it turns out as I make my way over there that it's a 12-year-old boy who's feral, who's been raised by dogs or something, we think, and can only act like a dog. He can only bark, he can't speak, he can't stand on 2 feet, and nobody can help him. And through the course of the movie, even though he brings out horrible recovered memories in me and horrible associations, I reach out to him and he to me, and we kind of heal each other. It ends up in a climax in the middle of the desert and near the Dead Sea in the Negev Desert, and I have kind of a spiritual healing epiphany there.
You know, my heart's breaking just your description of the film.
Yeah, it's something. It was really something.
And
Derek Jacobi's in it. Sir Derek Jacobi is the head of the hospital, and
incredible international cast. Yeah.
Yeah, I know, and some great Israeli actors, Ayelet Gerer, and it's great.
It's very dark material, though. Did you have any trepidation about living in that place in yourself for so many months?
Yes. It was at times grim, but finally very educational and uplifting and inspiring. But I had about a year to prepare for it, so I went to Israel for the first time. I'd never been there before. I met Paul Schrader there. We went over the script at one point and spent a couple of days there. And then, I went to some concentration camps in Poland and Germany, spent a month in Germany and talked to survivors in Los Angeles and Israel and Europe, and saw many, studied as much as I could in the course of a year. There are people who spend a whole lifetime studying the events of that time and
sure.
And only scratch the surface, but I got what I could in that year, and it was amazing.
That's a real gift, a year of preparation for something like that. But
yeah,
working with Schrader, you're working with he's a brutally honest and kind of uncompromising artist, so I can't imagine what you're expecting before you met him, but when you finally did and started this collaboration, how did he surprise you? What surprised you about him?
Oh, he was... spectacular. Well, early on, as I've done with some directors, but I knew that he and I had to closely collaborate on this and really kind of make this thing together. I said, are there any movies that I should see that I've missed? Because I'm always, there are many movies that I've missed. And he sat down, and we were in a restaurant in Israel, actually, and he wrote out on a napkin 20 movies. And I went about, when I got back to the States, and got them, many of them on Criterion, and looked at all of them and all the extra materials, so really took kind of a little course. And that was fantastic. Then, of course, I realized that he was early on with Pauline Kael, and a very serious and respected, spectacular authority on the history of cinema, and I read Schrader on Schrader, which I recommend if you haven't read it to anybody. It's terrific. And so I saw these movies, some of which he said the number one movie was Rules of the Game, which I'd never seen, believe it or not. And then Tokyo Story was the second one by Ozu. A lot of film people, a lot of people know that and like it. He said a couple of movies that he sees before he makes any movie is A Performance, which I'd seen but hadn't in a long time, and The Conformist by Bertolucci. Hadn't seen that in a long time, so I saw those. Vertigo is his favorite Hitchcock movie.
I know he's crazy about Bresson, too, the Pickpocket, I think. Was.
Yes, I saw Pickpocket. He said that movie was what made him do movies. Every movie is about a man alone in his room in a way that he's done, Taxi Driver and all those movies. So I saw that. Masculine Feminine is his favorite Jean-Luc Godard movie that he recommended. La Clisa is an Antonioni movie that I enjoyed no end. Seven Men from Now is by Bud Bedeker. And he talks about it in Schrader on Schrader. He was kind of a B-Western director that a lot of people like. Very interesting. And then Fassbinder, Ali Fear Eats the Soul, was a fascinating movie. So anyway, I saw those and many more. He's just so smart. It was just great to be with him, but always surprising, too, passionate about. And we could talk with a lot of fun about American football and American politics. He's just He's just great to talk to. And at times, he's mysterious and inscrutable and very focused and direct. And sometimes, you don't feel like you can really talk like sometimes I like to do around something and at length about something. You have to really kind of get to the point and cut to the meat of what you're talking. But then at other times, he'd be wildly open and personal and accessible and just great to be around. And when he laughs, he's a very serious and imposing fella. Sometimes you'll just be with him in a car and he'll be thinking and you just have to kind of be quiet and sort of live in this sort of changed air and atmosphere of seriousness and serious focused vibration, you know. But at other times, he laughs. He likes to have fun, and when he laughs, his eyes crinkle up in a sort of a squinty, almost innocent, childlike way, and he comes out with a full-bodied, unbridled laugh that is absolutely delightful and infectious.
I was wondering that what his style of directing was, because you've worked with some of the best. I mean, you've worked with Woody Allen and Spielberg and Altman and Cronenberg and on and on. What makes his style of direction unique?
Well, he's great. His story sense, you know, I mean, in my humble opinion, I just have this little experience with him, but he knows movies so well. He knows what his taste is so refined. He's so sophisticated. He knows what he wants. He's decisive. He's not intrusive in the acting, but he will he'll tell you just the thing you need to. You know, I came to trust him to terrifically, and he would tell me just the thing that I needed to, you know, make it better. He'd be very good, but then he's got a passion and an endurance kind of willpower during the course of this movie. It's a very difficult thing to make a movie, but this was particularly difficult, I think, in a lot of ways, and it was his singular will and to keep going and to every day kind of fight things out and to make up the shot and figure out what the best shot was. And all through editing, I saw him, and because I did a lot of post-production stuff. There was like a week of ADR and looping. It's just very impressive, his determination, his stick-to-itiveness, and his will to make a movie when, you know, sometimes the crew is not speaking English and other people are, you know, here and there. It's sort of one person is sort of leading this charge and making this movie, and it's conspicuously him. He's just great.
And for this role to be one of the great challenges that you've ever tackled, I hear actors speak of enjoying epiphanies in the creative process and finding moments of transcendence and that being the ultimate reward. What kind of rewards did you get from playing this character, and how does Schrader help to facilitate those?
Well, my gosh, you know, he turned me on to not only the world of cinema that was an enhancement and expansion for me, but on this subject, you know, he had books on German circus things and it gave me material, and just the way, just his, you know, his thirst for truthfulness and depth and authenticity sort of, you know, infected me. And while doing a part like this, you know, it really enlarged, I think, my experience of the whole thing. And he's amazing. He's a kind of surprising mix of a lot of things. You know, he seems in some ways to be a very kind of, you know, man's man kind of Hemingway-like, almost kind of virile, kind of two-fisted kind of a guy. But he's so refined and intuitive and receptive and artful, that when sometimes you'd watch him planning out shots and sort of devising the movement of the camera, and he would become like a dance master. He's kind of almost balletic, and in the way he moves and his sensibility. It's a very interesting mix. Sometimes he'd, you know, in a rehearsal room, just lie down on his stomach on the floor and look at the script and be in a very kind of unexpected, you know, way. He's just spectacular.
Oh, wow. You've seen the cut of the film. What do you want people to take away from it?
Well, I think it's really something. I've seen a cut of the locked film, and I have yet to see all the final sound mix put in,
right.
And the music, which is going to be great. I saw the temp mix, but and in a way, I've seen this movie more than any movie that I've ever made, because usually I'm curious and I see a movie after it's finished and then I kind of put it on my shelf and never watch it again. Even when I happen to buy it on TV, I kind of flick by it. I don't know why.
Right.
But this movie, because I knew I was going to do the ADR, extensive ADR stuff, there's narration that I do in it, I asked them for a cut of the movie a month or two before I did that, and like I did in rehearsal, I'm nothing if not conscientious. I'd sort of rehearse the movie every day for a year and do many things, kind of immerse myself in it. But when I had this cut, I'd watch it every day, in fact, which finally helped, but I got to know it and admire it in a lot of ways, in different ways than I ever had. And then seeing him refine the final 11th hour decisions of the cut, I was just, you know, I got very involved in it, in my thinking and feeling about it, and impressed by him. I think it's amazing. I like it a lot. Who knows what impact it'll have on whom, but it's a very serious, unexpected, unique kind of movie.
Do you know if they have a release planned for it yet? A release?
I don't know that that's been planned yet.
I think
that's all in the works.
Okay.
But he's very entertaining to be around. He's got, he's been doing it for a while, and so he's got great. He's a great raconteur. He's a great storyteller, and he's got great show business stories with everybody who he knows. You know, that are interesting.
We cannot wait to welcome him on the show. And Mr. Goldblum, thank you so much. We love you on the show, and we respond so much to your passion for what you do.
Oh,
and
nice,
please come back to us whenever you'd like. You have an open invitation to come.
Anytime you want, Jamie. It's been a pleasure to do it.
Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye now.
Bye. Bye, sir.
Jeff Goldblum, there it is.
That was awesome. You did a great job. I mean, he was great.
I love that interview. And I love that guy. What movie is that from? I sound like I'm one of those characters in it. I love that guy. He's fantastic. And the film, the chat room's been buzzing throughout this interview.
Yeah.
Thank you all so much for joining us for this show. And we're so glad that you're in harmony with us and our appreciation of what we spend every week talking about. And Goldblum is fantastic. Goldblum is infectious.
Yes, he is.
His passion for what he does, it's just infectious. And I was just on a high for days after that interview. It was a great time and a great addition to tonight's show, a great closer for tonight's
yes,
show.
Yes, it is.
Jerry, any last thoughts before we head off into the horizon here?
Well, I'm hoping that on Sunday we get to hear all these great stories.
That's
you
right.
Know,
Let me tell the audience real quick about that. Mr. Schrader, last month, you know, we knew that we were going to do a Schrader tribute all along. We've been talking about it since we began the show last year. I was putting together the first request I sent out was to Paul Schrader himself. And it was the first response I got back. I never expected a response. And he said, how about March 30th, which was a full month away. So I said, great. And then the people with the tribute started pouring in, too. So, now, it was a full month ahead of time, so we would try to get in touch with him again to verify Sunday. He may or may not be there. unless I receive an email. If I receive an email that tells me something differently, I'll let everyone know through our MySpace. But he is slated to be here Sunday. It's just tricky because if you dedicate yourself a month ahead of time, being a busy person like he is, never know what pops up in that amount of time. So we're working on him. We're going to send him this tribute show. Maybe that'll be some extra grease to get him.
the door. Of course.
But we did the tribute show because we love we genuinely love and admire the man. We've been planning it all year, so we're happy that we're finally able to give it to you guys. We're going to close out the show. Also, another announcement about another Paul Schrader film that we didn't get to speak of, probably the most challenging movie he's ever done, Ambitious Mishima.
That's probably one of the first ones I think I watched.
A Life in Four Chapters. Sorry we didn't get to speak of that, but I will plug the DVD. It's going to be coming out in May, I believe.
Criterion.
Criterion.
And as I said last week, you feel free to send, buy that for me if you want to get me an early birthday gift. That would be the one.
Mr. Schrader is intricately involved in that, as all the Criterion films. I believe he does commentary.
And that's something I like. The list of films that he gave Mr. Goldblum to watch.
My favorite part of the interview.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, he's just such an eclectic mix that, he throws in Seven Men from Now.
Yeah.
And you got Tokyo Story, Rules of the Game, Ollie, Fear Eats the Soul. I mean, that's a wild combination of films.
Yeah. It's great. We're going to be cut off now. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. We'll see you Sunday night.
All right. Thank you, everyone.
Feel free to leave comments and rate our show if you'd like for tonight. We appreciate it. Anything you guys can do for us.
Yeah.
Good night, everybody.
Good Bye-bye. Night. Thank you.
If you want to make an impact online, GoDaddy.com has what you need. .com names as low as $1.99, plus world-class hosting, fast and easy website builders, and much more. Plus, as a listener of Movie Geeks United, you just have to enter the code MovieGeeks, that's MovieGeeks, upon checkout, and you'll save an additional 10% on any order. Some restrictions apply. See site for details. Get your piece of the internet at GoDaddy.com.